You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
William Cope Moyers was a golden boy, the son of Bill Moyers and a father in his own right, when he suddenly became swept up in a vicious cycle of addiction to alcohol and crack. He's called his latest book, which is published by Hazelden, Now What? An Insider's Guide to Addictions and Recovery. And in it, he shares his experiences and offers advice for navigating the tricky waters of substance abuse and recovery, not just for himself, but for his devoted family members who were with him every step of the way. And his family, parents Judith and Bill, join him now to talk about it. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And William, you were here for an earlier book called Broken, which also dealt with this. What's different about this book?
Leonard, this book really is oriented towards people who stood at the abyss of their own now what question, like we did as a family many years ago. My first book, Broken, was a memoir. This one is really a guide to help people who need to navigate those tricky waters and get from the problem to a solution.
So is that why you brought the parents along to attest to that?
Well, they've certainly been there and done that. They're veterans. They wrote the foreword to the book in part because families oftentimes are struggling with what to do.
How long have you been sober?
18 years and about 4 months now, a day at a time.
Now, how did crack become your drug of choice? Don't most people of means prefer straight cocaine?
Well, a drug is a drug is a drug, and it doesn't matter whether you have means or have nothing. The substance takes everything from you.
And what did you like about getting high?
It took me out of the real world into a world that I thought was better or easier, and when in reality it took me into a place of darkness.
Some people call it self-medicating. Did you feel like you needed to self-medicate?
For a while, and then I felt like I couldn't stop of my own free will to the point that, I was in the clutches of addiction in 1989.
And how old were you when you started?
30 years old.
So you were not a kid. This was not the typical story.
Well, I don't know that there's a typical story. I mean, the bottom line is the common denominator, I guess. Addiction, doesn't discriminate. It steals from everybody, robs from all families, and affects us, to the point that we don't know what to do.
How long before you realized you were addicted?
I started to have a sense in my late 20s, in the late 1980s, that something wasn't right with me and that if I was going to get better, I needed to get help. But I was terrified to admit it and terrified to ask for help.
Bill, William says that our society has become both very open about addiction and yet surprisingly lacking in information about it. How is addiction misunderstood?
For too long, it was thought of as a moral failure that people used because they were bad. And, of course, what we've learned, Judith and William and I and many others, is that it's a disease that hijacks the brain and takes over and controls the steering mechanism of your will. That's the big change. It's moved from being thought of just as a moral failure to a disease that needs treatment.
In your foreword to the book, you reveal how little you knew about it when William was first spinning out of control. At the time, what did you think addiction was? Did you see it as a moral failure? It's hard to do that when it's your own son.
Yeah, I had an uncle who was a drunk. That's what we call them in East Texas. He was an out-and-out drunk, and he was a sort of form of nuisance and amusement in our family until he one day struck my father, my elderly father, and I had to have him arrested. That's when I realized that it was something more, but I didn't give much thought to it. I'm 79 years old and still the squarest guy on the block. I've never used any drug. I've had, alcohol, but I just thought of it as an excess of a good thing. And, of course, it's more than that.
Well, a lot of people will take a glass of wine and not think twice about it. There's a big difference between that and drinking yourself into oblivion or taking drugs that make it impossible for you to think straight. Judith, when did you first become aware of William's problem?
When he was 30. His wife called me and said, I haven't heard from him for 2 or 3 days, and that's not like him. He was a reporter at that time for Newsday. And he was on the police beat and the court beat, so he was often out and around with the police. But she said, this is not like him. So I said, you stay right there. He'll call you at some point, and I'll go look. Bill was out of town. So a friend of mine, Bill William Josephson, who was also our lawyer, went with me. And because he knew how to do these things, we pinned down his location to Harlem. And Bill Josephson and I went looking on foot in Harlem on one of the hottest August days you can imagine, and we found him in a crack house.
And in a crack house? What was that like? That must have been shocking.
Well, I was shocked out of my mind. I couldn't imagine that. He had been our golden boy. He was one of our three children that we didn't have any sort of an adolescent breakdown. He was easy. He was easy kid. And a super kid. He did everything. He played all sports and did really well, got first teams, and he played in every band and orchestra there was and ran marathons and so on. He was the last person in the world I would have ever expected to find like that.
And did you realize at a certain point that this was really a family problem, not just Williams?
It became my problem sort of instantly the minute I saw him. Then, that's a mother's kind of a thing, I think. But then, clearly it was a family problem. We had no idea what to do. We were totally ignorant about addiction.
William, what your mother is saying suggests that anyone can become an addict. How much of addiction is biochemical? How much do social factors play into it?
Well, there are a lot of factors that play into it. Some of them are bio. Some of them have their origins in the brain and the chemistry of the body. Some of them have to do with behaviors. It's hard to get your arms around the totality of the complexity, if you will, of this illness. But the fact of the matter is it is an illness. It does affect, about 1 in 10 of us, although I think all of your listeners probably have been touched directly by addiction one way, shape, or form. But there's no question that it's an illness that's hard to understand until you grasp it in its totality.
It's a mystery to me why I can have a second glass of wine and not want a third, but the person next to me needs a second, a third, and a fourth. Now, why? We are the same kind of people.
And that's why AA doesn't let you take that first glass, because you're going to want a second and then a third and then a fourth. Mm-hmm. Is that what happened with you?
Sure. They always say in recovery programs, one is too many and 1,000 are too few. I think for people like me, that's unquestionably true. So I don't go there. I have to stay in recovery.
But it's one thing to drink to excess, because that's alcohol is quite easily obtained. Crack is a whole other thing. How did you wind up taking crack?
Well, the illness is progressive, Leonard, and I went down that road from smoking marijuana casually and using alcohol at the legal age of 18 in 1977 to a bottom that included crack cocaine, because that's all that seemed to, quote, work for me, close quote, at the time.
And does it really have an effect on the brain? Does the brain change as a result
Absolutely.
Of the addiction?
Absolutely. Science is helping to understand that more and more. All the time, as Bill said, as my father said, it hijacks the brain, and I also say that it steals the soul, and it causes rational people to do irrational things and moral people to act immorally, good people to do bad things.
We produced a 5-part series for PBS about our experience with William. It was devastating for the family, a real impact on our other two children and on both of us. But the second broadcast in the series was with someone whom Judith found out about and heard and put us in touch with, Stephen Hyman, who was a neuroscientist at Harvard. And he's the one who used the term when I was interviewing him for the series of The Hijacked Brain. And he explains with great graphics and detail how, for certain people, the brain is changed by the chemicals that they intake. And then that brain begins to respond to the need for more, and you lose control of your will.
Mm-hmm. And addiction has also been described as an allergy of the body. You know what that means?
I do, and in the sense that I have a bad reaction. It may make me feel good, not addiction, but the use of the substance makes me feel good in that moment. But in fact, I'm having an adverse reaction to it, to the point that I go counter to everything that really matters to me.
My guests are William Cope Moyers, whose latest book is Now What? An Insider's Guide to Addiction and Recovery. It's published by Hazeldun. I guess. And his parents, Judith and Bill Moyers. Judith, a commonly held belief is that you have to wait for an addict to hit rock bottom before you can intervene. Is rock bottom, is that one of those addiction myths?
I think it is one of those myths that's now been disproved, but I would turn this question to William, because his answer is so authentic, if you don't mind. What do you say about that?
Well, did you hit rock bottom?
No, because if I had hit rock bottom, Leonard, I would be dead. And the only bottom with this illness, I argue in the book, is death. And anything short of that is a way out. To that point, though, because my parents didn't give up on me, even though I'd given up on myself, because they were there for me when I really was sick and needed help, is, I believe, tantamount or critical to my ability to have gotten into recovery.
Well, when does the family help in a positive way, and when does it just become enabling?
That's a good question, because that's what we struggle with for so long. As Judith said, she pulled him out of a crack house the first time. He relapsed a second time. And then the third time he relapsed, we found him in a crack house in Atlanta, Georgia, had to go in with two policemen with their guns in order to get him out. And to me, that was his rock bottom. But on the way to the center where he went after that, I realized that the next bottom was his death. And that and during that period of time, that 10 years, Leonard, we often debated what was the right thing to do. How do we do this without enabling him? How do we deny that without angering him? It was a real trauma.
Well, he would disappear for days at a time. The first time you heard about it was when his wife called. But then when he disappeared at other times, Judith, did you immediately assume that he was on another bender?
I began to do that. But I might say that one of the things that we had to learn, and the reason that families have to get treatment too, and that's the best thing I think that families can do for the addict, is for the family to look within itself, each individual person, and say, how are we? Are we okay, too? Can we really support this? Can we stand by? And can we learn when to stand back? Because you do have to learn that, too. But I go to a 12-step group, too, and in that group I learned early on that I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it. And that's sort of a mantra that parents or spouses or bosses or whoever have to say. I can only do so much, but there are things I can do. For one thing, we can say, it matters to me that you live.
And were you afraid he was going to die?
Oh, there were times when I thought it wouldn't, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, parents suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome with addiction. I mean, I still, at 2 o'clock in the morning, if a phone goes off, I'm startled and frightened, because it could be the police, it could be him, it could be the doctor, it could be someone else calling. If I hear a car screech in the middle of the night, which we heard often when he was in his heavy using, I panic. Not I don't panic, but I get tense. And so I think all of us in individual ways suffer from PTSD, dealing with a son or daughter who is addicted.
Do you ever worry that you might slip back?
I don't worry about it.
Because I know when I quit smoking, it took me a whole year to get past the point where I didn't think, oh, maybe I'll just take one puff. Eventually, I got past that. You've been sober for a long time now, yes. So are you past that?
I'm past that, and to the point that I don't worry about it, but I have to remain vigilant. You know, we at Hazelden don't cure addiction. We offer people a solution. I still have the illness, I believe. I still have it. I've been in remission from it for a long time now. But I still have to be vigilant and take care of myself on a day-to-day basis.
You describe the brain as having layers of Swiss cheese. How does that play into the way addiction works?
Well, we all have layers of Swiss cheese in our brains. That's how the brain is constructed. And there are holes in those layers in everybody's brain, and those holes expose us to certain sets of internal and external factors that can, in some cases, lead to addiction when those holes line up together.
We're going to take a little break, and actually we're going to get a weather update, I think. No? Okay. Well, we're going to take a little break anyway. My guests are William Cope Moyers, Vice President of Public Affairs and Community Relations at Hazelden Foundation. He was here last to talk about his best-selling book, Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. And this time he's brought his parents, Judith and Bill Moyers. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with three members of the Moyers family, Bill and Judith, and their son, William Cope Moyers. William has written his second book, and it's called Now What? An Insider's Guide to Addiction and Recovery, with a foreword by Judith and Bill, and it's published by Hazelden. Wanting to get high in some way is really part of human history. Some scientists even speculate that drugs may have contributed to early human brain development. Why is it that some people, I know we kind of skirted around this before, some people can drink or even use a drug in moderation, and others can't?
Well, it goes back to the science, the brain chemistry, the dynamics of the body internally, and what factors affect us on the outside as well. As my mother and father have indicated, and as they did in their PBS series many years ago, now that's still relevant. Science is still grappling with exactly how that happens, but there's no doubt that addiction has its origins in the brain.
But we have people say to us, drink in moderation. Does that really mean anything to somebody who has a problem? Just say no.
Leonard, I think everybody intends to drink with moderation. And then, as William said, the brain reacts to some differently from it to others, and the next thing they know, the moderation has become four drinks or six tokes or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. But as you said earlier, Bill, some people can have one or two glasses of wine and not have any desire for a third glass, and other people drink themselves into oblivion.
I don't believe it's a matter of will, though. I believe that it's an unsuspecting ambush by forces both clinically in the brain and culturally and physically.
Is there a genetic predisposition? Can I have a predisposition and never take a drink and never know that I'm a potential alcoholic or a drug addict?
I actually have a little vignette in this book that talks about a woman whose parents were alcoholics, and because of that, she never took a drink or a drug until she broke her leg while skiing, and then immediately when she was treated with pain meds, she became addicted to those pain meds. That unlocked Pandora's box.
Now, a lot of people go into rehab and then slip back.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Yeah. How many times did you go into treatment?
I was in treatment four times over 5 years between 1989 and 94.
And Judith, when did the family decide that everyone should go into treatment?
I decided immediately that I was going to have help, that I was not going to get through this. I'm a big believer in asking for professional help about everything. And so I instantly did, and then I joined a 12-step group, and I think both of those are key for family members. You do need professional help, and for some people, and I'm one of those, groups are good. I had been very involved some years before with the National Red Cross, who's established grief groups all over the country. And that was a new idea back in the 70s. And I thought, I know this works. The group thing works. And I also knew about cancer care. That was another one of those groups that had started about that time. So groups are good for me. And I think that got me through the panicky part and contributed to my sort of maturing, because I was so ignorant of addiction. I really didn't know anything about it. Bill and I both grew up in teetotalers' homes. We had no alcohol in our homes we grew up in. We had no knowledge of it. Anybody who drank anything, anybody who kept beer in the refrigerator was really, questionable character.
Isn't it sometimes difficult to find a good group?
No, not really. In a city like this.
It's anywhere. Not
anywhere, anytime. There are groups all hours of the day and night. You can go at lunchtime. You can go before you go to work. You can go after work. You can go at midnight. No, it's not difficult.
Yeah, if I could say that the biggest help to me was other people who've been through this experience. I mean, I was like the roadrunner in that old cartoon who's driving down the road, moving down the road, and suddenly hits a cliff or falls into a deep hole. When this happened, when he disappeared and had to go to treatment, I was stunned. I would never have expected it, and I was frightened, and I felt alone, even though Judith and I shared everything we could. I felt alone. And it was in the family program that we went to after he was in treatment that I looked up at this opening session, and the last people to arrive there was a banker's family from Little Rock, Arkansas. They came in like a troop of wet hens, the father, the mother, and then the children behind them. They were there because one of their children had collapsed and disappeared too. And suddenly I felt, you're not alone. And a friend of mine here in town picked me up one day and took me to an Al-Anon meeting. And I began to hear other fathers talk about this. And that was the biggest help I had, came from people who've been through the experience. Last night, Leonard, somebody asked us, the three of us, what do you do if you don't want to live? And our answer was, turn to anybody and tell them that. It doesn't have to be a doctor. It doesn't have to be a professional. It can be somebody that can recognize the signal and act on it.
And are you recommending that if there is somebody who has a problem with alcohol or drugs, that the whole family go into treatment? Is it possible to get through it without everybody learning more about it?
It's possible, I'm sure, but not for me. And I think you don't wait for the whole family. You go. Some individuals need help more than others, and in my case, I need group more than others, perhaps. But I think you do need to go, and you don't wait till your beloved addict and your family goes to treatment. You go on to treatment for yourself.
But what are you learning from that? Obviously, you're understanding that what other people go through when there's a problem in their family, but can it also teach you how to help?
Yes.
In this case, right. William?
It helps you not to be a codependent, which is another rough place to be. It helps you not to be a codependent and to learn to be a supporter in an appropriate way. It reminded me, I have to say, of when I first went to a group, I guess it was you, William, who went to nursery school, as we called it then. And I thought, I didn't know that all four-year-olds did that. I thought that my child was the exception, and then he was either exceptionally smart or exceptionally bad about eating or whatever. I learned in the parents' groups of parents of four-year-olds, oh, no, this is what four-year-olds do. And that helped me be a parent. And I had that same feeling going to 12-step group for myself.
My guests are William Cope Moyers. He's written a book called Now What? An Insider's Guide to Addiction and Recovery. It's published by Hazelden. And Judith and Bill Moyers, who wrote the foreword. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And we have people calling in who want to share their experiences. So before we get to some more of the things that have occurred to me after reading the book, I thought that I would ask James from Queens to join us. Hi, James.
Hi. I called in because I'm the parent of a young man now who has had various addiction problems. It escalated from alcohol at the age of probably 13 to his 26 years old, various times, polysubstance, we'd call it, anything available. And he's been in various programs. He definitely has been diagnosed with, mainly bipolar, schizoid disorder, and has gotten into serious trouble with the law as well as a result. However, and has taken and has been compliant with his medications. Unfortunately, he's been compliant with other people's medications, as often happens. However, what's sorely overlooked and underreported is the link or the comorbidity of substance abuse and mental health issues. And it's definitely been avoided by the AA, now referred to as the 12-step community, et cetera. I'm not putting it down. I'm a parent. I don't have an issue myself. However, that's the purpose of my call. If they could please address, the comorbidity uh-huh. of mental illness and substance abuse, it's probably 99%. Coexisting.
Well, I kind of addressed it a little bit earlier when I asked about self-medication, mm-hmm. because I suspect that people who feel that they're troubled are looking for ways to help themselves before, if they don't go to a doctor, and not everybody wants to be put on those meds.
Undoubtedly, that's true. In fact, our veterans coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq are coming back in numbers that indicate that we have a real epidemic of addiction among those struggling with PTSD and other war-related mental illnesses. The fact of the matter is that Hazelden, where I work, about 85% of our patients do show up with co-occurring disorder. They've got addiction to alcohol and other drugs, and they've got depression or bipolar disorder, and it's folly to try to treat one without treating the other. It is a process, though, and people who have both oftentimes will struggle for a while before they can get their sea legs about them.
Well, what happened with you? You said you went into treatment a number of times. Mm-hmm. Why didn't the first ones work?
Because I did not understand that my alcoholism was not just a part of me, it was all of me. And that to recover from it required that I take care of that mind, that body, and that spirit. I also sort of had my own idea of what it meant to regulate my use or recover in a way that was unique to me and not in the way that works for so many people, including, you know, your listeners today.
Let's take another call. Annette, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I want to ask Mr. and Mrs. Moyers if they ever felt guilty that there was some deficiency in their parenting that led to their son's addiction.
Oh, absolutely, positively. You know, night and day, you think about that. You're pretty sure that you did something wrong, and you test everything. But that's why I personally needed professional help and group work. Because I learned that everybody does feel that way. Spouses even feel that way. Bosses sometimes even feel that way. Employers feel that way. And you have to deal with that. I think there's not a perfect parent walking this earth, and all of us have made parental mistakes. I'm sure of that. But
well, what conclusions did you come to? How responsible did you wind up feeling in the end?
I didn't feel responsible. I did not feel responsible. My
I'm sure there are parents who are abusive and do all sorts of things that would lead someone to become addicted to something. But then there are we see so many cases of families that were perfectly happy and still the problem arises.
My weakness, I think the worst thing that I did as a parent was to be ignorant of addiction. Mm-hmm. We picked up no clues. The fact that we didn't have an adolescent breakdown with William, that's not normal. We had adolescent breakdowns with other children. We didn't have that. And that should have been a clue. When he was a senior in college, he was arrested during his Christmas vacation. And it was sort of sloughed off by the authorities and by us, and we said that was not like him. That was once. He's a senior. He's going to graduate. It's Christmas, and so on. We didn't take that as a clue. Why would a person like that, who was doing well, high-functioning person? And that's another thing. It's so American to be high-functioning. If you're high-functioning, we think everything's fine. And we were just sure that things were fine because he was such a great person.
I felt guilty for a long time because when he was young, when he was 6 months old, I went off to campaign in the campaign of Kennedy and Johnson. And then I went to Washington to help organize the Peace Corps. And then I wound up at the White House. I was an absent father. If it hadn't been for Judith, I don't know what would have happened to our family. So when this happened, I thought, I must have contributed to that. The hole in his life must be his father. I don't know to this day. I've had help, and I've talked to other people about it, and I've seen fathers who were gone all the time. The fathers who've gone all the time tell me, my kids are great. They never had any of this problem, so who knows? But I'm over that guilt. As Judith said, you have to – I want to say this to James, by the way, who called earlier. It is a fact, we know from our reporting for the series on PBS, that mental illness is different from people who don't have a mental illness, and that you've got to get a special kind of help when your son, your daughter, or yourself are suffering from this multi-pronged attack that is – induced in part by your mental condition.
Now, William, I'm assuming that you also went through some psychotherapy along with all the other treatments.
Yes.
I don't want you to embarrass your parents, but did you blame them at all?
No, and in fact, for the record, I have to say that, you know, as I've talked in all of my public speaking for Hazelin, that I lacked for nothing emotionally, I lacked for nothing morally, I lacked for nothing financially, I lacked for nothing spiritually. I grew up in a household that was nothing but loving, and yet I still became addicted to alcohol and other drugs. I don't blame my parents, but at the same time, because there's no blame to be given there. At the same time, what I did learn in my own experience and in my journey is that I needed to become my own person, and I needed to become comfortable in my own skin, defects and all. And I think I learned that along this journey of recovery.
A caller has suggested that AA may not be the best place for somebody who has a mental illness because they're not really professionally prepared, equipped for it.
Well, AA is not a professional program. It's a self-help or mutual help group. People who struggle with mental illness, just like those who struggle with addiction, oftentimes need professional counseling, one-on-one group, or treatment. I wouldn't suggest for a moment that any 12-step group is going to be the answer to people who are still in the throes of their addiction or their mental illness.
You know, I had to look hard to find things to admire about George W. Bush politically, but I admired him enormously personally because he quit on his own. And there are 1,000 ways into addiction, and there are 1,000 ways out of it.
That's
and
right.
George W. Bush found some way to deal with his addiction voluntarily and willfully, and I salute him for that. Mm-hmm.
How much feedback did you get from the Close to Home program that you did on PBS?
Huge. Judith and I were talking last Huge. Night about that. Huge. We think of all the thousands of hours of television we've done, it had the most impact. People still come up to us and say it changed our lives because we reported it. It was grounded in journalistic endeavor, questioning, interviewing, analyzing data, speaking to the experts, speaking to people who'd been on this journey themselves, and it just rippled out across the country because this has been a secret disease. This has been, for reasons of shame and pride and whatever, it's been the thing you didn't talk about, even in your family. Mm-hmm. I didn't tell my parents about their beloved grandson for a long time. I didn't really talk about it with our daughter and other son, who were also casualties. There's traumatic fallout for every member of the family, but it's not talked about. Series aired, bang, everybody could talk about it.
Well, if somebody is struggling with the problem right now, what would you suggest is the first step?
The first step is to admit that you have the problem, and the second one is to immediately ask for help.
We're going to take one more call from a listener who has experienced this on his own. Jeffrey from Manhattan, how are you on the air?
Mr. Lopez.
Yes, sir.
And how are you, sir?
I'm well. You've got to make it quick, Jeffrey. We're pretty much out of time,
okay.
But we thought your story was important.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I've been clean now for 20 years. I quit smoking crack back in 1993, and I had to do it on my own because by going to groups, they wanted me to accept certain things that I could not accept. That told me I was an addict, and I never believed that. I believe that I know who I am. I know that I made a personal choice to do what I had done to experiment. And I got caught out there, and I learned how not to empower the substance by saying it this and it that. It has no personality. You have the personality. You're the only one who can make a decision to change your life and find your way back to who you are. You will experience some physical changes. Metaphorically, it's easy to walk forward in snow than it is to walk backwards. And trace your footsteps. So you will experience some discomfort, but you just have to bite down and realize and use what's called the power of realization and realize the better life you will have for making a better decision.
William, you've been nodding your head.
Yes. Jeffrey, good for you. There are many pathways to recovery. You walk down one of them, and you're a better person for it in the same way that I've walked down one, and I'm a better person for it, too.
Just one more thing. Since you all think that it's a disease, what are your feelings about the way society deals with this disease? We put people into jail. In New York, we put people into jail for long times for drug abuse.
If we can beat the stigma of addiction, then someone who feels himself slipping down a bad path can say, I got to have treatment. It just in the same way we say to a diabetic, you've got to have treatment. You need treatment right away, and there is treatment. Or we say, if you've got cancer, you don't wait. But people wait a long time. They get a lot of consequences from waiting, and there's a lot of tragedy around that waiting to get help.
We need lots of research. We need a Bill Gates Foundation for research into mental illness and addiction.
Judith and Bill Moyers wrote the foreword for William Cope Moyers' latest book, Now What? An Insider's Guide to Addiction and Recovery, published by Hazelden. Thank you all so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.